Very good. So, yes, the topic of the talk, narcissism and absence, I was given. So that was actually a blog post that I wrote some time ago. So it was suggested that I use it as a topic for a talk. It's a bit of an unusual title for a talk. I probably would have chosen something a bit friendlier if I was giving a talk. But anyway, the idea here is talking about the idea of a self and particularly when that goes wrong. And just to explain briefly why the title was there, it was just a thought that I had some months ago, and I was thinking how usually when we think of problems and mental difficulties and things like that, we tend to sort of say that a person has something, right? So a person has a mental illness, or they have a psychological disorder, or they have an emotional problem. Yeah? So it's something extra that they have. And if you think of somebody who's a narcissist, like an extreme egoist, right? Then we say it's somebody who has a very strong ego. They have a lot of conceit or something like that. And it's just suddenly occurred to me that that's actually the wrong way to think about it, that these things are not presences. They're actually absences. And somebody with a very strong ego is not somebody who has something extra that other people don't have. It's somebody who's missing things, right? Missing the ability to reflect, missing the ability to empathize, missing the ability to realize that they are not really the center of the universe. Yeah? So rather than thinking of these things as a problem which we need to get rid of, then perhaps we could approach it in a different way by thinking that let's look at those qualities which can be developed, right? And let's look at those things which are missing and ask what can be used to complete that. So that's just a brief explanation of why I use that phrase. But I'll just talk a little bit more about it and a bit more about what the issues are. Now, of course, you know that you know who you are, right? Yes, and when you have to fill out a form or something like that, you say, I am so, it says, what's your name? And you put down my name, and somebody asks, who are you? And you tell them who you are. And that's all pretty straightforward, and you never thought it was a problem until you came to Buddhism. And then all of a sudden, this became like a quandary. And then the next time you're faced with a form that you had to fill out, it wasn't just a form, it was a metaphysical crisis. And I'm filling out the form. Do I just write Sujato Bhikkhu, or do I write the collection of five khandhas conventionally known as Bhikkhu Sujato? I mean, what do we do here, right? So, of course, you know, we shouldn't confuse, and this is one thing which we have to learn in Buddhist philosophy, we shouldn't confuse the Buddhist teaching of not-self, okay, with the way that we deal with and relate to a self in ordinary everyday life, okay? So in Buddhism, we can think of it in terms of a conventional or an empirical self and a metaphysical self. So this is a distinction that I wanted to draw right at the beginning, because it's very important that you understand that, okay? So when we talk about the Buddhist teaching of not self, okay, it doesn't mean that you're not a person, okay? Phew. It doesn't mean that you suddenly disappear and vanish. Oh, I'm not here, right? Okay? All it means is that when we talk about a person, it's just a kind of a label, it's a conventional label. And like any conventional label, it's a bit limited and inadequate, right? The thing which you are labeling as with your name, that thing changes. Okay, Sujato, who's sitting here before you, is different from the Sujato who was here, what is it, a year or two ago giving a talk, right? I'm fatter for a start. You're all thinking it, I know. Well, look, I'm sitting next to Ajahn Brahma all the day. It kind of, it's catching, you know. Okay, so the thing changes, yeah, but the name stays the same, right? And this is one of the reasons why this name gives an illusion of permanence, okay? And so, like, you know, you think about how that is. For example, you think about how you handle responsibility, yeah? Let's say you break the law, yeah? You rob a bank, yeah? A week later, the cops come knocking at your door. You robbed the bank. No, that wasn't me. It's impermanent, right? As a set of sankharas and activities and intentions, that's all past, right? What you're seeing in front of you is completely different. Yeah? Right? And the cops say, wow, that's so deep, yeah. You're busted. Come with us. Right? So in a conventional, ordinary, everyday psychological self sense, we all have selves in that ordinary sense. That's not. We shouldn't make a problem about it, and we shouldn't get confused by it. And we shouldn't confuse the level of the teaching that's aimed at. For example, in Buddhism, we know that, say, an arahant, right, a fully enlightened person, has fully understood this teaching of not self. Yeah? But at the same time, an arahant, one of the epithets to describe an arahant is bhavitatta, somebody who has a fully developed self. Okay, so an arahant is bhavitatta. Yeah? And actually, it's quite interesting. If you ever meet, very well-practiced monks or nuns or whatever, I mean, I've given up trying to guess who's an arahant and who isn't an arahant, but you do sort of meet some pretty, pretty extraordinary people in different traditions and so on. And one of the things that's characteristic is that people are very, they've got a lot of personality, right? They're very much themselves. They're very unique individuals, yeah? And it's not as if sort of when you become enlightened or you become spiritually advanced that somehow you sort of drain all your personality away and you just become this kind of mindless automaton, this kind of robot. I am an arahant. I am just five khandhas. Right? That's not how it is, yeah? Actually, people become more alive. And I think the reason is because you become less self-conscious, right? You become less invested in trying to impress people and trying to fulfill some kind of role or something like that. And you're just who you are. And so my experience anyway has been that people who are very spiritually advanced, the more they've just got a lot of personality and they're very kind of quirky and funny and different kind of people. Weird, I think, is the word I was looking for. This is this like conventional self. Now, what the Buddha was talking about when he's talking about anatta, right, was not this conventional kind of self at all. It's talking about a metaphysical self. And by metaphysical self, essentially what we mean is something like a soul which survives your body and gets reborn and so on. This is this Brahmanical idea of the Atman. In the Jaina tradition they have the Jiva. In Western traditions they talk about a soul and so on. And so this is an idea that you have some kind of permanent, eternal, spiritual essence, which is you. That's who you are, and it always will be like that. Yeah? That's what the Buddha was saying is not self. So what we're taking to be that permanent kind of essence doesn't really exist. Right? So when you get attached to that and so on, then that's a form of delusion, it's a form of holding on. Okay, so that's that kind of distinction. Now, when we come back to consider that conventional self, right, then if you look at the Buddha's teachings, and both in explicit statements and also in implicit things, you can see that there are a lot of things which are teaching us how to develop ourselves, right? And the Buddha says, "Atta dīpaṃ viharata," yeah, "Atta saraṇaṃ," yeah, have yourself as your refuge, yourself as an island, yeah. And so this kind of statement is often confused by people who are to sort of try to read some doctrine of a metaphysical self into the Buddha's teachings, right? So they see a teaching like that that says, "Atta dīpaṃ viharata, atta saraṇaṃ," or let the self be lamp unto itself. Right, and this is how it's kind of translated, right? But of course, it doesn't mean that. It's not meant in a metaphysical sense. It just means you should be your own refuge, right? You should rely on yourself. Yeah, you shouldn't let somebody else make your decisions for you and be responsible for your spiritual life. Right? So this is this conventional self which we develop in Buddhism. Right? So developing yourself and having a strong sense of self, having self-esteem, having self-confidence, all of those kinds of things is good. That's not a problem in Buddhism. That's an advantage. Yeah? And if we see practitioners who are lacking in those kinds of things, yeah? This is sometimes is a problem that we have in Buddhism. A practical problem is that often people who need more self-confidence, they need more self-esteem and so on, and they come along and they see the whole not-self doctrine. doctrine, and they actually use it in a kind of wrong-headed way. It's like the Buddha said, grabbing the snake by the tail. Yeah? And so it actually makes people worse. So this, it's very important to be aware of how this thing should be applied. Now, even though it's essential for us to have a healthy and balanced sense of a self, sense of who we are and so on, sometimes that can also become dysfunctional, it can become extreme. Huh? And so this is what in psychological terms they call narcissism, or the technical term is narcissistic personality disorder. Now, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist, so please don't take anything I say about this as being medical advice, all right? It's just some reflections. I've taught courses multiple times in Sydney with Buddhist psychotherapists and so on, and I've looked into these issues and so on, because I've tried to understand some of the behaviors of people around me and the people that I've encountered. You see, one of my problems that I have as a Buddhist monk is that I had a very nice upbringing with kind and loving parents who were very good to me but not overly attached. You see, and this makes it very hard to be a monk, right? because when I'm trying to be like a teacher and so on, like I'm often faced with kinds of issues and behaviors and things that I just don't understand, right? And I try to, why are this person doing this? You know, why are they always suspicious? Why are they always angry? Why can't they just chill, right? And then, of course, when you look at it, you realize, well, actually, there's something going on, right? There's some kind of emotional difficulty or something like that. And so I had to try to learn about these things, which are things that often I've never encountered before. And so one of the things which I've encountered a lot in Buddhism is this kind of narcissistic behavior. Now, you might think that, because Buddhism's all about not self and so on, that when you come to Buddhist practice and if you have narcissistic tendencies, then it would be undermined by the Buddhist practice, right? So you think that Buddhism would be good for it. But that's not the case at all, right? It's not the case precisely because of that difference between the metaphysical not self and the empirical not self, right? So when someone who's a narcissist comes along to Buddhism, they're like, hey, I really get this not self idea, yeah? I've so got no self, right? I've got like the biggest not self you've ever seen, right? My not self can just, you know, trash your not self. Right? Right? So you take these things the wrong way and it actually becomes like another defense mechanism, right? So I kind of struggle to try to understand this, and I think it's important to understand a little bit how this works, because we're likely to meet people who have these problems in our lives, and it's helpful to know how to deal with them. Word of caution in advance is that when we're thinking about these things, it's a very kind of normal kind of tendency that you want to end up labeling people. So you kind of end up dismissing people by saying, oh yes, you're just a narcissist, or you're just something or something. And that's not the point, okay? It's not about labeling people and putting them in boxes and treating them as less because there's something wrong with them, okay? The point is to try to understand people better. Okay, because sometimes people behave in ways that are just confusing, right? And it's disturbing and it's worrying. You don't know why they're doing that. So if you understand something about the mechanisms that's going on, then you can understand their behavior better. At the very least, you can protect yourself and the people around you and not be hurt by them as much. Yeah, and possibly you might also even be able to help them. So what is this problem with extreme narcissism and so on? What's actually going on? Well, remember where the word narcissus comes from, okay? Narcissus is a beautiful white flower which grows in Greece and places like that. And in the ancient Greek mythology, Narcissus was the most beautiful young man in the whole land, okay? A young youth called Narcissus. And all of the girls fell in love with him, and everybody wanted to be with him. But he never fell in love with anybody else. Until one day, he was wandering through the woods. He came to a very clear pool of water. And he looked into the pool of water, and he saw this most beautiful vision looking back at him. And he was like, oh my God, I have never seen anything so beautiful in my entire life. And he just stayed there with his own reflection. He's fixated on his own reflection and fell in love with his own reflection. Yeah? That's all he could see. Yeah? That's all he wanted. and everybody else he just ignored. So this is the legend of Narcissus, and eventually he died and he became this flower. So this is, you know, that these myths often they capture something very essential about this thing, like what we call narcissism today, right? This is essentially what it is you're transfixed by your own face, right? Narcissists are always about the face, it's always about the externals, yeah? Now, of course, most of us are kind of like that, right? Even if we don't really like to admit it, right? We want to make sure that we look nice when we go out of the house and we check the mirror and spend a little bit too long fussing over our makeup or whatever it is that we're doing, okay? Oh, I was just doing my makeup before I came out, actually. But you know, we all have narcissistic tendencies, right? And so some people sometimes tend to dismiss that and they say, well, there's no real such thing as, you know, a narcissist. What are you talking about? Everybody's a narcissist, right? But that's kind of missing the point, right? Because for most of us, those narcissistic tendencies are part of who we are, and they are moderated and exchanged with other things, and they're kept in balance by compassion and all of these other things, and self-reflection and all of those things. Whereas for a narcissist, they're not. It becomes almost complete or almost total, and it kind of dominates their life to an extraordinary degree. There's a wonderful story which encapsulates the difference, which is from one of the best books on Buddhism ever written, which is called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Anyone ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Yes, fantastic. What a great... Well, it's a general... I read it actually the year I started studying philosophy at university. It was the most useful philosophy textbook I had. You could basically just use that for all the answers in your exams and you'd pass with flying colours. Anyway, one of the characters in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is Zaphod Beeblebrox. Right? He's the coolest man in the universe. He's got two heads. He's a bit like kind of Keith Richards with two heads, okay? So, at a certain point in the story, he became the president of the universe. So he's like this kind of uber cool rock star with two heads who's the president of the universe. Now, at one point people developed a punishment, okay? It's like the worst torture imaginable, okay? It's the ultimate punishment, the worst torture in the whole universe, and that was called the total perspective vortex, okay? And what the total perspective vortex was a box that you went into, and it showed you your true place in the scheme of things. It showed you your insignificance in the whole universe. It showed this is what you are worth and this is the rest of the universe, right? So that you couldn't escape. And every single person who had been into the total perspective vortex had come out screamingly mad, okay? They'd never recovered. They were just gibbering idiots for the rest of their lives, okay? And when this veil of delusion had fallen away and you see really who you are, you can never recover from that. So anyway, of course, inevitably as these things happened, they captured Zaphod Beeblebrox. They were on the hunt from him because while he was president, he also stole the universe's fastest spaceship and things like that. So anyway, they got him and they put him in the total perspective vortex. I thought, that'll teach him a lesson. And then when he came out of it, he was like, wow, that was pretty cool. I really am the most important man in the universe. Yeah? So that's the difference. Yeah, it's the difference between an ordinary ego and somebody who's pathologically narcissistic. You know, pathologically narcissistic, everything is always about you. To a degree, it never occurs to you that it's not about you. But it goes deeper than that, right? Because not only does it never occur to you that things might not be about you, right? It never occurs to you that other people might be different, okay? So this is very important to understand when you're dealing with a narcissist. Narcissists will look like they're being kind and compassionate, okay? But it's just a show. They're just doing a behavior of those kindness and compassion, huh? Because that's how they get by, right? Because they've seen other people behaving in that way and they've seen that it actually makes them successful, so they imitate that behavior, right? But they assume that everybody else is doing the same thing, okay? They don't know that they don't actually feel compassion. They think that they feel compassion, But they think what they're feeling is the same as what other people are feeling, but it's not. Right? What other people are feeling is a genuine compassion. So this is this idea of absence. And there's the sort of the technical understanding of narcissism is not really well understood in psychology. But it's one of the theories about it is that it's a developmental problem where essentially many of the higher aspects of emotional development stop as a young child, so that they're like around childhood around 6 or 7 or something like that, and so the development of things like compassion, empathy, and so on tends to mostly happen after that age, right? 8, 9, 10, 11, then kids are sort of learning about others and learning about kindness and morality and things like that. And so those important aspects of personal development actually don't happen, right? So it's not as if their compassion is less than other people. It's just that they've never really developed compassion in the first place. Yeah? Again, it's this idea of absence. It's an incompleteness. But one of the things which is quite a bit problematic with narcissism also is that unlike most mental illnesses, it's actually very pleasant to have it, right? It's like Zaphod Beeblebrox, he's cool, right? The fact, of course, he leaves a train wreck of destruction in his wake, of course, doesn't concern him, okay? But for him, he's fine, right? And narcissists are often can be quite happy, and they can be quite functional. In fact, they can be extremely functional because they're not distracted by things like, you know, caring about anybody else, right, or acknowledging the existence of other people. So it's not always that way. If a narcissist's world collapses, right, then they will suffer a lot. But as long as they can manage their world so that they really are the center of their world, they're pretty happy, yeah? So they're not going to actually seek any help. And you find that there are a lot of high-functioning narcissists in professions like politics, right? Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, it's not kidding. Politics, you know, things that you might expect, like people who are super wealthy, celebrities and things like that, you see a lot of narcissistic behavior. And I've seen certain politicians, you know, who I've met personally, who I, you know, I won't mention any names, but certain politicians who just happen to be prime ministers of Australia currently, who, and you meet them, and there's this like, everything just runs off them, right? They just run. It's just like the thing of water off a lotus, right? It's just nothing touches them. Yeah, I guess this is pure kind of narcissistic behaviour. We have another good friend in Australia, who is also a politician, Jeff Gallop, and he was exactly the opposite. He was like a very kind of compassionate and very kind of richly feeling person, you know, who was like actually a very rounded human being. And he eventually had to resign as a premier of WA because he was suffering from depression. Yeah? Because he was too much, everything was too much, right? And all of the stress and the pressures and so on that's being put on you. So actually in those very high pressure, high functioning jobs, you can actually sometimes function better by being a bit pathological, right? It's not uncommon, right? I mean, you look around the world. I mean, the leaders of multiple countries, you can look at them and think, yeah, well, that actually explains quite a few things, you know. You know, leaders of certain large northern countries who like to ride around bareback on horses, for example. And you're thinking, what's going on with that, yeah? And of course, one of the things is that you are likely to find, because of that thing, you're likely to find narcissists sooner or later in your life. Hopefully you won't have somebody who's like that in your family, but if you, you're quite likely to find them in your work sooner or later, and usually as it happens, they'll usually be your boss, and... And, you know, there'll be somebody who, you know, there'll be somebody who kind of does their job, right? Objectively does their job very well, right? They get good results and so on. And when they kind of present to the, you know, the board or something like that, they always have good figures and everything looks like it's going great. Except it's just a nightmare for anyone who's working underneath them, right? And they don't have any concern for that, yeah? And so there's this kind of dichotomy, again, this kind of thing of the face, yeah? So what do we do about this? How do we respond? Well, First thing to respond is just to try to recognize what's going on. Okay, if you suspect that something like that's happening in your life, just go and Google it and read around and just learn a little bit about the behaviors and so on, and you'll find that there are certain kinds of typical patterns that you see with narcissistic behavior that you can learn to recognize things. So, for example, one kind of pattern you can recognize is that there's like a co-narcissistic pattern where a narcissist will tend to surround themselves with yes men, right? So that they're the only ones. Everyone else around them is very kind of pliable, very kind of they won't speak up. Anybody who speaks up gets chucked out. Yeah. And or put to one side, so they can end up, and they will often marry somebody like that, right? And so that there's a kind of interdependent relationship there. The partner is very kind of has never really developed a strong sense of self and a sense of self-confidence. So they in itself are attracted to the narcissist because the narcissist projects this great self-confidence and so raises them up. But it's not a very kind of healthy relationship. I mean, it can survive, but it's not necessarily, very healthy. So this is the first thing to do, is to learn a little bit about it and recognize some of the patterns. Now, one of the things that's useful for is it can protect you from being a victim, right? Or from thinking of yourself as a victim, because sometimes you're just confused. And this is certainly how I've been in these kinds of situations. And you're just confused. Why is this person doing this, right? What's going on? What did I do wrong? Right? And you internalize it, and you think you must have done something wrong, and you bend over backwards again and again and again to try to make them happy, right? And to try to fix all the problems and so on. You're thinking, oh, I must have done something wrong, right? So when you understand a little about those patterns, you realize actually you haven't done anything wrong, okay? The second thing you realize is that bending over backwards to make that person happy is just going to make things worse, okay? Right? And so this is where you've got a choice in how you deal with it, okay? There's basically two ways you can deal with it, right? Number one, you can just keep on bending over backwards, keep on, letting them get away with things and not doing anything about it, right? And sometimes you have to do that if you don't have a choice, right? If your job depends on it or something like that, or if it's a close family member or something and you haven't got any other way of doing it, sometimes that's all you can do, is just get by in a way that's not going to cause too much offense. The other way you can deal with it, and this is a better way if you can, is to draw some boundaries. Okay? And so you can say no more. Yeah? That's it. And you draw the boundaries. Now, when you draw the boundaries, you have to remember when you're doing that there's no point, zero point, in negotiating the boundaries. Okay, the whole point about narcissism, the narcissist won't actually recognize any boundaries, right? And so this is why you see this kind of narcissistic behavior sort of plays out in this kind of way. So just give you kind of one example of that. When one of the Buddhist centers I was engaged with at one time, we were having a kind of discussion, and I said, oh, we should have, I suggested we have like an 8-precept day. And they didn't know what the 8 precepts were, and I kind of explained. And when we got to the bit about no makeup, right, it was like, no. we can't have no makeup, right? Because, again, it's all about face, right? So this is a person who's never actually, her face has not been seen in public for quite some time now, right? And so that becomes very problematic. So all kind of rules and principles and so on, They shouldn't exist for the narcissist. The narcissist is the source of law and order and all of those kinds of things. So they might put up with rules if they have to, but they really don't like it. So negotiating with them about boundaries is not going to be very useful. The important thing is just to draw the boundary. Okay? That's enough. Okay? And what that boundary might be, it might be saying, look, please, don't email me after I leave work. It might mean, please respect the decisions that we make within the project that we're doing, or whatever it might be. And so there's some kind of boundary that needs to be drawn. And so you just draw that boundary. What you'll find if you do that, right, is that usually the narcissist will freak out, okay, and that they will hate you, okay? And there's not very much you can do about that. I mean, obviously you do your best. You be as kind as you can, you be as reasonable as you can, and all of those things, and they will hate you anyway, Okay? It's irrational behavior. Right? That's why it's a personality disorder, because it can't be managed in that way. Yeah? So don't expect anything else. Maybe they might pleasantly surprise you, but don't expect anything else. And you can't really cure a narcissist. Okay? This again is a very unfortunate thing, but it's true. There's not much you can do to help them. But the best thing actually that can help them is if people around them consistently start drawing these boundaries. Okay? If you draw them and somebody else doesn't, they'll just go and hassle that other person. Once they give up with you, they'll just go and project and hassle that other person. But if the people who are around the narcissist consistently draw the boundaries, then that might be something that forces them to sort of reflect and to start to grow and so on. So that's really one of the best things that you can do. So when we come back to this idea of a self and what we're doing as a self, the whole purpose of a self, right? Why do we have an identity? Why do we have a name? Why do we have a self? Well, the real purpose of it is simply so we can get by, basically. It's so we can cope, yeah? Because the world is a complicated and confusing place. So we construct an idea of a sort of safety, of a security, of a permanence, yeah? And that helps us to manage. And this is in the Indian traditions; they call this the ahankara, the very good, very useful word. They often translate it as ego or something in the West, but ahankara literally means I making, yeah, ahankara, mamankara, I making and mind making. And one of the things that this points to is that this self is not something that's given to you, right? It's not something that just happens. Yeah? It's not something that's inevitable. It's a process that we do. It's a work that we do. It's a work in progress. It's something we are constantly creating. We are making ourselves. Every moment, every thought that you have, where you're thinking about yourself or what you want or something, this is ahankara, right? Every emotion that you have, every time you get offended when someone criticizes you, every time you get, you know, proud or something like that when someone praises you, all of these things, you're building up your sense of self, right? You're building up the ahankara. And like everything else in the world, like everything else in Buddhism, it is impermanent. So overcoming the problem of the attachment to the self, right? It's not something that we have to do. We don't have to get rid of the self, okay? We just have to stop feeding that process, yeah? We have to stop feeding that process of the ahankara. And just as like somebody who has that narcissism pathologically, why do they do it? Well, it's kind of a defense mechanism. They're lacking so many things that they need to hang on to this self, right? It's how they can cope with the world. And underneath, when that breaks down, you know, they're just like a child. They don't have those kind of adult coping mechanisms that we have. You know? And so for somebody who's either pathologically narcissist or indeed just for ourselves, in order to reduce our reliance on that self, on that ahankara, we need to develop our kindness, our compassion, our understanding, all of those qualities. And the more we develop those things, the less we have to insist on that self, the less we have to build those walls of defenses, the less we are scared of empathizing, the less we are scared of loving and being a kind and open person. So when we're developing and wanting to overcome this sense of attachment to self, don't just think about it as a meditation exercise or something like that. Don't just think about it as a theoretical thing or anything like that. Understand what is the purpose of the self, right? And so that we can replace, instead of continually manufacturing a self, we can develop all of those qualities, the compassion, the love, the joy, and all of those qualities which make our attachment to self redundant. We don't need it anymore. Yeah? And so when we do that, not only are we helping ourselves, but also helping people around us. Yeah? And also we're helping to cope if we do if we are unfortunate enough to have somebody who's pathologically narcissistic in our lives, it's helping us to deal with them. We won't take the things that they do and they say so personally. We won't feel the need to criticize them and put them down. We'll try to help them when we can. But at the very least, we can help to protect ourselves and to protect others. So anyway, I think we're kind of running out of time now, but that was just a few thoughts on narcissism, the sense of self and so on. We might have time for a few questions. So any questions, comments, or good jokes if you've heard any recently, we'll have them as well.
Thank you, Bhante. Not sure whether it's a simple question. This sense of self, not the pathological narcissism, is hardwired into us. Each one of us, even in the animal kingdom, is the same thing. You know, it's either individually, the individual ego, or the collective ego. And our whole purpose is to propagate our type, our genes. So that's inbuilt in us. So spirituality is actually trying to reduce this sense of self, the individual ego or the collective ego, and propagation of ourself. So would that be in line with what you have just said?
Okay, so the question was, even in the animal realm, we see a kind of sense of self, don't we? Yeah. So there's been some interesting kind of studies done on that, you know, whether animals can recognize themselves in a mirror and this kind of thing. And so there is some kind of sense of self, although it's of course much more primitive, much more basic. Yeah. So we really evolve that sense of self through our use of language and concepts and ideas and views and so on, and develop theories and attachments and so on around it to a much more sophisticated degree. That's not a bad thing. In fact, that's a good thing. That's an essential thing. Okay, so yes, in all sentient beings, there's an underlying tendency, right, towards attachment to a self. And when beings get reborn in different realms and so on, that underlying tendency will manifest to a greater or lesser degree, as is appropriate in those conditions. Yeah, but when we're in the human realm, that sense of self manifests in those very sophisticated ways, because we can master language, and because using that we can then reflect, right? So once we can use the word I, right, we can ask the question, who am I? Yeah? So actually language and theories and ideas about a self is an essential prerequisite to being able to reflect on it and to be able to let go of it. So those things are not bad things, they're just limiting. Yeah? So we can think about the sense of a self among, say, young babies or animals and so on as being a very kind of very, very primitive expression of that latent tendency. And so we have a much more sophisticated expression of that, one which enables us to go beyond it. Peter.
Ajahn, you have shared about how we would cope with someone, the coping mechanisms for us to deal with someone who is a narcissist. What if this person that we have to deal with is really high powered, and we're just caught in the situation that we cannot eject ourselves out from it? How can we deal with this or better manage it?
Well, like I said, basically you've got those two choices. You can either just bend with it and just, it's not good, right? But you can get by like that. But that's only if you don't have a choice. If you have a choice, then draw boundaries, right? So just draw boundaries. But the boundaries have to be clear and consistent, okay, and reasonable. Right? So you're not trying to hurt that other person, but you're just saying, you know, actually, this is kind of boundaries that all of us follow all the time, right? I mean, just give you an example. Like when we're at Bodhinyana, we have some people who are a bit mad, who call us up to talk about Dhamma and so on. There's a number of people they call from like Portugal or England or something like that. And not just once or twice, but again and again and again. And, you know, and so the monks are sort of going to roll their eyes and it's like, oh, so-and-so is called. Who wants to take the call today? And all of the monks are like, oh, you know. And it's one of the things I talked to the monks about it. I said, look, you know, the fact that somebody is imposing themselves in that way on you, right? I mean, you think you're being kind by talking to them and listening to them and being compassionate and so on. But the fact that they are so extreme and excessive in the way they're doing it is just narcissism, okay? And you don't help that narcissism by indulging it, okay? So actually the appropriate thing to do is to say, you know, we've already spoken to you, and look, and I'm sorry, but it's not appropriate for us to be doing counselling and so on, you know, on the phone, and we really think that you should find somebody in your local area that you can talk to, yeah? And so you say something like that, and then they'll keep coming back with all of these arguments and ideas and so on and so forth, and you just keep repeating that, yeah? And you just keep, you don't try to argue with them, you don't try to negotiate it, right? You don't say, well, look, you can call every second Sunday or something like that. You just say that's enough. Clear boundaries, and you keep that clearly and consistently, and they'll probably get, the most likely outcome is they'll get really angry with you and they'll yell at you and abuse you and all of those kinds of things, yeah? And you just have to say, okay, you just have to accept that's part of it. It's not about you personally, okay? It's just about the fact that they're, just think of it like that, like there's an emotional development which stops when you're like six or seven, right? What happens when there's a six-year-old who really, really wants something and you say no, right? They throw a tantrum, right? And but they can, of course, they get over it. So a narcissist really doesn't have any more capacity to deal with those kinds of emotions than a six-year-old does. Yeah? So you can just think about it like that, and then you can kind of have compassion for somebody. You know, when they get angry and so on, you're not feeling hurt by it or anything. You expect it, right? If they could cope with their emotions well, they wouldn't have behaved like that in the first place. Yeah? So you just kind of expect that. You don't take it personally, and you just hope that, you know, after some time that they can sort of calm down and things can work out. Sometimes that can happen, sometimes it can't, and sometimes you just have to say, look, sorry, don't want to deal with you anymore. Yeah. So, it's not a very nice thing, but sometimes you just have to lower your expectations a bit because you can't solve everybody's problems. Yeah. I mean, the reality is that almost all psychiatrists will refuse to see narcissistic patients. Yeah. It's true. Most psychiatrists won't see narcissists. Why? Well, because therapy is inherently narcissistic, right? I mean, that's what therapy is. You get to sit there, I can say anything I like, and this person will listen to me and not judge me, right? It's a narcissist's dream, yeah? I can just talk about myself for an hour? Wow, that's just, you know. So, I mean, in normal therapy, there's always that danger that it becomes narcissistic, but of course, you can negotiate that in various ways. But when someone's so extreme, you can't do anything about it. So therapists actually, most therapists will actually refuse to treat narcissists, yeah. I mean, narcissists very rarely come to therapy, of course. They'll only do it if they're forced to, right? But even so, most therapists won't, yeah. Well, that's different, okay? So there's a difference between boundaries are okay. Boundaries are good, right? You need boundaries, but boundaries have a function, okay? So in the case where there's things going wrong, then sometimes you need to draw the boundaries, right? So that, but then you also need to know your wisdom for when those boundaries have become inadequate, right? And then you need to let go of those boundaries. But letting go of boundaries always needs to be done with wisdom, right? And that's why, for example, when you're doing metta meditation, you know, of course, the outcome of metta meditation is you let go of all of those boundaries between self and other, liked and disliked and all of those things. But you do that gradually. And you do that by building up this kind of strong basis of happiness and joy and contentment and all of those things. And then gradually you can let go of all those boundaries. And when it's done well, in a healthy way, it's fantastic. Yeah? But don't be afraid to draw boundaries. Yeah, in that conventional way, when there's some harm that's coming, yeah, Again, not doing it in an extreme way, always be reasonable, always be moderate, but it's much more important just to be moderate and consistent in the way you do that. Yeah? You know, basically, it's just one of the most common things that you find is that narcissists won't follow the same rules that everybody else does. Yeah? And they'll always have some reason why they're the exception. Yeah? So this is, again, it's just a simple thing you can see. If you insist that everyone follows the same rules, if someone's repeatedly making problems out of that, then that's a sign that there may be some problem.
One more question.
One here and one here. We've got it at the back. Okay, go
on. You mentioned that the sense of self is also dependent on the language used, right? Mm. So I wonder whether in some society, when a child is taught from young to use a humbler form of addressing oneself, or calling themselves using the name rather than I, whenever they speak to the elders, whether that will help in reducing this tendency. Because if you objectify, you use the person when you're referring to yourself,
right.
You are seeing everybody, same usage as you are seeing everybody using a third person perspective. So will that be helpful to address this?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether... I have a little bit of experience with that living in Thailand, where they do have that kind of very, very stratified way of referring to yourself and so on. Especially for example, sometimes it's kind of disconcerting, right? So the normal term of address that somebody who is a not particularly high class woman, especially younger woman, who may be especially like working class or something like that, uses when referring to herself is nu, which literally means mouse. Right, so she refers to herself as mouse or rat, right, when she's talking to you, right, and that's a bit disconcerting, right. Whereas monks use like a formal term like atama pap, right, and if you're talking to the king, then you use something like dai prabat prajao yuhua or something like that, which is exactly as fancy as it sounds. It's like, when you're talking to the king, you say something like, you know, groveling underneath the soles of your feet, you incredible royal holy eminence, something like that. So personally, I haven't really seen that has that effect. On the contrary, it seems to sort of reinforce the differences in the strata in society, which I think tends to create more of a kind of attachment to it. There's a funny story about that, which is about a monk called Lumpur Khun, who was one of the most famous monks in Thailand, and also quite a kind of notorious monk for his very, how should I put this, direct mode of speaking, which a lot of people were more accustomed to hear among gangsters and in the marketplace than they were to hear coming from a monk. Anyway, of all the many, many terms you can use for I and you in Thai, the worst is gu and mung, right? You never say gu and mung, right? That's just like the gutter trash talk, right? But Ajahn Khun would always say gu and mung instead of all of these highfalutin words which he was supposed to say. Anyway, one time the queen comes to visit, huh? And the queen's advisors come to him and say, oh, look, you know, it's so wonderful that you've agreed to receive the queen and so on and so forth, but Lumpur, please, just don't say gu and mung, right? So anyway, the queen comes along and she's going around the monastery and Ajahn's sort of showing her to the different parts of the monastery. But, you know, every time that she would talk to him and make small talk, then he never said anything in response. And she began to be a bit, you know, worried what's going on. And eventually she said, look, I'm sorry, but you haven't said a word to me this whole time. And I'm beginning to be worried. And he just said, well, they told Gu not to talk to men. Anyway, we should probably go on to the next question. One last question.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, Ajahn Sujato, for your enlightening speech just now. My name is Kadiam. Last time, I'm working as a teacher. Well, my question is about the children education, especially in Singapore.
Sorry, spiritual education?
Children education in Singapore. Well, I believe that narcissism is a type of personality disorder that parents and the environmental surrounding them affect this kind of personality disorder, I believe. Yes. So, well, last time when I worked as a teacher, I noticed that some of the children, they are being pushed down by their friends. They believe that they are stupid. But for me as a teacher, I do not believe that they are stupid.
Right.
Because they say that, well, my friends say that I'm stupid, and so on. But, well, you are not. You have potential. You can learn something. But in the other side, the other students, they feel that they are so proud. Oh, I'm so smart. I'm in the high top school and so on. But actually, you're not really that top. You're not really that smart. You are just average, for example. Would you have to give some advice to us, especially for the parents here, so that to motivate the children, to give them confidence that they can do well in school, but try to be, how to say it, how to balance it up so that they will not go to the narcissism part.
Thank
you very much, Ajahn.
Yeah, it's difficult to say 100%, but I mean, okay, so first of all, yes, certainly the influence of parents and things can have an impact. We can't blame parents completely, though, because people are people, right? I mean, they're already a person when they get conceived, and they've come from their past lives, and they've already got their tendencies, and parents have some influence, schools have some influence, friends have some influence, culture have some influence, and so on. But certainly I think we should do, you know, normal common sense things, like, you know, put some boundaries around our kids and make some rules for them and don't just indulge their every whim, right? And I think this is sometimes can be a tendency, especially in society, as our wealth increases, the number of children that we have decreases, and we end up really kind of spoiling our kids too much. So, you know, I strongly, you know, recommend just moderation when dealing with your kids, you know, give them some treats and so on occasionally, some toys now and then. But, you know, the kids don't need lots of toys. I mean, to be honest, kids can have fun with a bunch of sticks just as much as they can with expensive toys. I mean, let them use their imagination, create things with bits of paper and scissors or whatever, you know. You don't have to be buying expensive things for them all the time. You know, we had a wonderful, really moving, actually, short film made by a Sri Lankan Australian, young Sri Lankan Australian woman. She made a film on the theme of wealth and poverty. I know I have to go in a minute, but anyway, it's only food. The theme of wealth and poverty. And she juxtaposes these images of kids in Sri Lanka and in Australia, you know, and you can see a picture, they'd have like a picture of kids in Sri Lanka, you know, playing cricket, yeah, and then a kid in Australia playing a video game of cricket on their Xbox, right? And which one is real wealth, yeah? And so, you know, definitely try to encourage that and some moderation and so on around the kids. In there's been a bit of a shift in that understanding of how to treat kids. Like in the West, from about the 70s on, they had this real thing about self-esteem, right? You had to build self-esteem in the kids, right? You couldn't criticize them. You had to always tell them that what they did was good and they were trying well and so on and so forth. And that was a bit kind of extreme and a bit simplistic. And that more recent studies have moved away from that, and they now show that actually, you know, just be a bit more common sense with it. It's okay to criticize kids sometimes. Sometimes they do things wrong. It's okay to tell them if they make a mistake. That's all right. That's part of learning how to grow up. So we shouldn't indulge them too much. But it also depends on the personality, the character. And certain kinds of children will respond much better to that positive reinforcement, and others will respond much better to critical reinforcement. Yeah? And so that's just different kinds of people will respond in those different ways. You know, I mean, I tend to be that person who will respond better to critical reinforcement, right? If somebody just comes along and says to me, oh, everything's good, it's all good, I'm like, well, you haven't paid attention to what I'm actually saying, right? You're not looking closely, right? If you look closely, you can see, you can tell me something more meaningful about it, right? So I tend to, you know, that's just my natural tendency. I tend to kind of dismiss those kind of blithe positive reinforcements. It doesn't mean anything to me. Whereas if someone takes the time and trouble to actually consider it and give some proper critical reasoned feedback, that's something I really value. Yeah. So, but that's not everyone. Somebody else might be different. Yeah? So, I don't think there's one blanket thing, but I think just using common sense is a good thing. It must be hard as teachers, like when you see kids sometimes who are getting really spoiled and so on excessively by the parents, and you know, sometimes you can see these problems in development, and you're like, I really wish I could say something, but sometimes it's not easy to say something. Okay.
Ajahn, thank you very much for sharing, because if he goes on, he has to be a bodhisattva because he can miss his lunch.
Oh, I know. You'll make very bad karma if I don't get to eat.
So let's do three sadhus appreciation, and then we'll do three prostrations.